Palestine was hardly Britain's to give away, a young John F. Kennedy wrote in a 1939 letter to his father. He further remarked, "After all, the country has been Arabic for the last few hundred years."
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
To be in deception, to be in fear, to be deceived is a much worse place to be than to have some truth. Like it says in the Bible, the truth will set you free.
And ye shall know the truth. And the truth shall make you free.
Here's an Israeli confessing the truth.
Washington is Israel's most subservient colony.
The government's been taken over. The date, I say, it was concrete that there was a coup and we lost our government was November 22nd.
Yes.
The assassination of Kennedy.
I'm a former Zionist and a former Jew. Let's go on a journey together to uncover the truth.
I think Americans largely get it. They know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
On 9/11, why was this Israeli woman smiling?
Well, big catastrophe, and I'm Israeli. And I hope that now people understand what we have to deal with, the kind of people that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
This is World Trade Center 7, which wasn't even hit by an airplane on 9/11, free fell into its own footprint at the speed of gravity and was an obvious controlled demolition. One of Benjamin Netanyahu's closest friends, Larry Silverstein, a major Zionist financier of Israel who was deeply connected with numerous Israeli terrorist leaders such as Yitzhak Shamir and Ariel Sharon, leased the World Trade Center shortly before 9/11 for a mere $14 million. When the Twin Towers collapsed in controlled demolitions engineered by the Israeli Mossad, Silverstein worked through his buddy Elliot Spitzer, the pro-Israel Zionist governor of New York, to use an insurance scam that pocketed him a $4.5 billion windfall.
Elliot Spitzer, he got me the $4.5 billion. We got very, very lucky. It was very, very good for the family, very good for us, and we were very, very fortunate.
We are benefiting from one thing, and that is the attack on the Twin Towers and Pentagon and the American struggle in Iraq. The Israeli Mariv newspaper quoted Benjamin Netanyahu as saying in April 2008, he reportedly added that these events swung American public opinion in Israeli favor.
And I hope that now people understand what we have to deal with, the kind of people that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Israel's main strategic goal with Operation 911 was to spread panic and terrorize the public into hating Arabs and Muslims so that Americans would support perpetual Middle East wars on behalf of Israel. What's the truth about Al-Qaeda, who was blamed for 9/11, and the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS? Both were created by Israel's Mossad and the CIA, who used them as puppets to deceive the public and fabricate phony justifications for U.S. wars, primarily to advance Israel's goal to create a Middle East empire.
From the Jordan River to the Middle East, that's all ours. It was promised to us. There's no Palestinian nation.
There's a fight between the good and the bad, the good and the evil.
We will bomb Shifa Hospital, all the hospitals, all the tunnels, and kill them all. It's about time. We are the center of the world now.
Here's former CIA director and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo dancing with the Israeli army, apparently to celebrate the joint Israeli-U.S. genocide in Gaza. Israel has been planning the total genocide, expulsion, and subjugation of the Palestinian people for many years. In February 2008, Israeli General Matan Vilnei threatened Palestinians in Gaza with a bigger Holocaust. In 2017, Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich unveiled Israel's blueprint to commit genocide against the Palestinians in the Decisive Plan, also known as the Subjugation Plan. When asked if he intended to slaughter entire Palestinian families, including women and children, Smotrich said, "In war, as in war."
Everyone knows that what happened in October 7th was an Israeli setup. Everyone knows
what look at him smile.
It was an Israeli setup.
This is Israel's 9/11. This is Israel's 9/11.
Israel used its second 9/11, the October 7th, 2023 incident, as the justification to implement the Decisive Plan genocide of Palestinians that Smotrich publicly announced 6 years earlier.
All night I've been removing bodies from beneath the rubble, dead children. We pulled them from three locations.
And I would like to use the rest of my time to say how appalled I am that people are bringing up the Holocaust. Do not use other genocides to describe this one. I have been...
You've seen footage of...
shredded children's bodies. And that's my taxpayer dollars. We're going to bomb those kids.
So I think we should kill them all, if that makes you feel better.
Washington is Israel's most subservient colony.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living. The kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
JFK supported Palestinian refugee rights, opposed Israel's nuclear weapons program and expansionist war plans, and tried to force AIPAC to register as a foreign agent. From the moment he took office in January 1961,
preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, so help me God.
JFK made it crystal clear that nuclear weapon non-proliferation was a pillar of his presidency as part of his quest for global disarmament, the abolition of nuclear weapons and all weapons of war, and ending the capacity of all nations to wage war. His Zionist vice president, Lyndon Johnson, who was primarily loyal to Israel, did not share JFK's values.
I have already taken steps to coordinate and expand our disarmament effort and to make arms control a central goal of our national policy under my direction. The deadly arms race and the huge resources it absorbs have too long overshadowed all else we must do. We must prevent that arms racing from spreading to new nations, to new nuclear powers.
Not only was LBJ opposed to every aspect of JFK's peace and disarmament policies, Johnson in the 1940s had illegally shipped weapons in boxes marked Texas grapefruit to Zionist terrorist militias who ethnically cleansed the Palestinians in the 1948 Nakba. Neither JFK nor his brother and confidant, Robert Kennedy, wanted LBJ in the White House, as revealed by JFK's widow, Jackie Kennedy.
It was only months after her husband's assassination
when a 34-year-old widow sat down to record more than 8 hours of recollections about her husband and his most private thoughts while they were still fresh. JFK and his brother Bobby on Lyndon Johnson, the new president.
Bobby told me this later, and I know Jack said it to me sometimes. He said, "Oh God, can you ever imagine what would happen to the country if Lyndon was president?" So many times he'd say it if there was ever a problem.
Lyndon Johnson was a pathological liar, as reported by Bobby Kennedy, who said, "LBJ lies all the time. I'm telling you, he just lies continually about everything. He lies even when he doesn't have to lie." Speaking of lies, by May of 1963, JFK was furious at Israel for lying to him constantly about their nuclear weapons program. Kennedy delivered a near ultimatum to Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion: allow meaningful American inspections of Israel's reactor in Dimona to prove it wasn't being used for nuclear weapons, or Israel would risk losing all American and Western support. Also, Ben-Gurion established his ambition to, quote, "abolish partition and expand to the whole of Palestine," end quote, as far back as 1937. When Israel attempted to conquer the Gaza Strip and the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula, seize the Suez Canal, and overthrow Egypt's President Nasser, with help from Britain and France, in the 1956-57 Suez Crisis, President Eisenhower kicked Israel out of Egypt using boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Lyndon Johnson, the leader of the Senate in 1957, strongly opposed Eisenhower's sanctions against Israel, but President Eisenhower overruled him and told Israel to pound sand and withdraw. JFK, who was also a senator in 1957, did not rush to Israel's defense or attempt to undermine Eisenhower's sanctions against Israel the way LBJ had.
Thousands of Israelis demonstrate in Jerusalem against withdrawal from Gaza and Aqaba. Mr. Ben-Gurion, the premier, enters to announce the government's decision to the Knesset, Israel's parliament.
Nearly the entire world applauded the Eisenhower administration for compelling the Israeli aggressor to back off. The American ambassador in Egypt said, "The U.S. has suddenly emerged as a real champion of right." Eisenhower's handling of the crisis was a high point of his presidency. It upheld the authority and moral stance of the United Nations and the ideals of the United States. Israel learned an important lesson from this humiliating retreat. The only way Israel would be able to conquer and hold on to the West Bank, Gaza, and vast tracts of Egyptian and Syrian territory in the 1960s was by placing a Zionist puppet they could control in the White House. President Kennedy had a warm and cooperative relationship with Egypt's President Nasser, whom Ben-Gurion hysterically denounced as a would-be Hitler, without any factual basis.
"Want to be friendly to all the world. Want to participate in the case of peace. Want to cooperate with the world to avoid war. We have to defend our territory against aggression, and we insist about gaining the rights of the Arabs of Palestine, the 1 million refugees. We are insisting and we are calling to give the Palestine refugees their rights, their territory, and their land, and their homes."
Overthrowing Egypt's President Nasser was one of Israel's numerous objectives that JFK opposed. Additionally, JFK was in sync with President Nasser in putting enormous diplomatic pressure on Israel's Ben-Gurion to allow hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes or be given the option of compensation and resettlement. This would have largely reversed Ben-Gurion's Plan Dalit, which Palestinians call the Nakba or catastrophe, in which Ben-Gurion and other Zionist terrorist leaders masterminded the ethnic cleansing of Palestine using terrorism and the mass slaughter of civilians to expel 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and destroy 530 Palestinian villages.
Palestinians who fled often carried only enough to stay away for a few weeks, hoping they'd eventually return home.
A lot of them locked their doors, put their key in their pocket, and then moved to safer ground. When you leave the house and you take your key with you, it's because you're planning to go home. In the case of the Palestinians, those refugees weren't allowed to return.
Refugees trying to return were often shot at. Zionist paramilitary operations also tried to prevent them from returning again by destroying the villages.
That act of preventing their return compounded the Nakba. So the Nakba is both the forcible displacement of Palestinians from their homes and lands and country, as well as preventing them to return once the fighting was over.
Palestinian society was dismembered, crushed. More than half of the Palestinian people became refugees, stateless, dispossessed of their land.
Over time, the State of Israel covered up the physical evidence of an Arab Palestine. Place names were often changed from Arabic ones to Hebrew ones. The Jewish National Fund embarked on a massive effort to plant thousands of acres of pine forests and recreational areas on top of hundreds of ruined Palestinian villages.
Even though these forests have now grown into big pine trees, Palestinians have not forgotten their homelands.
JFK's proposed return of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees would have upended Israel's violently engineered Zionist Jewish majority status. Prior to Ben-Gurion's Operation Dalit in 1948, Jews constituted only one-third of the population of historic Palestine, even after massive immigration from Europe over the prior decade. In 1947, Jews controlled only 7% of the land of Palestine before Zionist militias stole huge amounts of Palestinian land to create the State of Israel. Furthermore, JFK's refugee return would have de facto blocked Israel's long-game maximalist Middle East ambition to create a massive Greater Israel Empire from the Euphrates River to the Nile River. What Zionist rabbis called the Promised Land, swallowing all of Palestine and Jordan, plus large chunks of Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and all of Lebanon. Ben-Gurion utterly resisted JFK's Palestinian refugee return plan and wrote in the fall of 1962, quote, "Israel will fight against this implementation down to the last man," end quote. In fact, the Zionist Stern Gang terrorist leader Yitzhak Shamir, who later became the 7th Prime Minister of Israel, oversaw the assassination of UN peace mediator Count Volker Bernadotte in 1948, in large part because Bernadotte also, like JFK and President Nasser, wanted the Palestinian refugees to be able to return to their homes.
On the 17th of September 1948, Count Volker Bernadotte landed at Calandia Airport, north of Jerusalem. Heading towards the YMCA, the three-car convoy was suddenly halted. An army jeep pulled out from a side street to block the road. Three men in Israeli army fatigues sprang out of the jeep.
Then suddenly the count opens the window of his car so he can see what's happening. Then they identify him, and Yehoshua Cohen goes to the car, puts his Schmeisser submachine gun in through the window, and unloads on everyone sitting in the rear seat.
By 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Bernadotte lay dead in hospital. Politicians and diplomats representing their countries at the UN meeting in Paris came to Orly Airport to pay their last respects.
Following the Bernadotte slaying, Israel's Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion granted a general amnesty to all the guilty parties. He chose assassin Yehoshua Cohen to be his close friend and personal bodyguard at Kibbutz Sde Boker in the Negev. Ben-Gurion created and supervised the Mossad, and Yitzhak Shamir became the Mossad Director of Assassinations, a position Shamir held at the time of the JFK assassination in 1963. For Israel, the JFK assassination was the sequel to the Bernadotte assassination 15 years earlier. On top of everything else, JFK was livid at Israel's lobbyists in America, such as Abraham Feinberg and Isaiah Kenan, for shamelessly attempting to buy his entire Middle East foreign policy during the 1960 presidential campaign. He directed his attorney general and brother RFK to register the American Zionist Council, the predecessor to AIPAC, as a foreign agent. An attorney who worked for Israel's lobbyists wrote that this effort would eventually destroy the entire Zionist movement. Had the Kennedy brothers' registration efforts succeeded, it likely would have resulted in the end of the State of Israel, because these same American Zionist lobbyists for Israel, such as Abraham Feinberg, would have been exposed for funding Israel's nuclear weapons project, contrary to JFK's entire foreign policy. Furthermore, Israel's agents in America were illegally and treasonously stealing nuclear weapons materials from the NUMEC Apollo uranium plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania, and smuggling them to Israel. Ryan Dawson reports in his documentary that the NUMEC nuclear holding company was a den of Zionists.
Their directors were Ivan J. Novick, a future Zionist Organization of America president, and David Lowenthal, a refugee smuggler for Israel who fought in the 1956 war.
The FBI has photographs of Lowenthal shaking hands with David Ben-Gurion and Moshe Dayan, Israel's military chief of staff from 1953 to 1958.
Lowenthal's partner was Dr. Zalman Shapiro, the president of NUMEC, and also the Zionist Organization of America chapter president of Pennsylvania.
The American Zionist Council was pumping out propaganda about every aspect of Israel's nuclear program to deceive the American public. These treasonous lobbyists, who claimed to be Americans but were loyal to Israel, lied and said Israel's nuclear reactor in Dimona was built for peaceful purposes and couldn't possibly produce a bomb. If the Kennedy brothers had succeeded in registering the American Zionist Council as a foreign agent, which would have subjected all their records and finances to federal scrutiny, the entire nuclear weapons theft operation would likely have been unmasked. And had JFK found out about it, he certainly would have ended all military and economic aid to Israel, as he threatened to do three times starting in May of 1963. Israel would likely have collapsed, given its total dependency on American aid. Also, JFK might have asked the United Nations to rescind its 1949 vote that granted member state status to Israel. JFK might even have asked the UN to rescind its 1947 vote that partitioned Palestine like a crazy quilt and designated huge amounts of land to Zionist Jews who didn't even own that land.
Flushing, Long Island, the General Assembly of the United Nations has made its decision on Palestine. The map shows what partition means. The Jewish state colored light, the Arab state dark, Jaffa to go to the Arabs, Jerusalem internationalized.
no Arab state voted for the 1947 partition of Palestine.
The Arab delegates declare a boycott as the final roll call has begun.
In the face of total opposition from all Arab nations, including the Palestinians, the Zionist movement used bribery, threats, and even an assassination attempt against President Truman to pass the 1947 UN partition of Palestine vote by the necessary two-thirds supermajority. The U.S. State Department had strenuously opposed the partition of Palestine and the creation of the State of Israel, considering both to be contrary to American principles and U.S. interests, against indigenous Palestinian wishes, and a violation of democratic principles. The Joint Chiefs warned that the Zionist strategy will seek to involve the United States in a continuously widening and deepening series of operations intended to secure maximum Jewish objectives. U.S. Secretary of Defense James Forrestal said the partition plan and creation of Israel could endanger U.S. national security. Despite all this, U.S. President Harry Truman supported both the partition of Palestine and recognition of Israel. Yitzhak Shamir's terrorist Stern Gang attempted to assassinate Truman in the summer of 1947, a few months before the partition vote. Harry Truman's daughter, Margaret, disclosed this incident in her biography of her father. Yitzhak Shamir's Stern Gang mailed letter bombs to Truman and senior White House staff members that could have killed or maimed them. Although the Secret Service intercepted the letters, Truman got the message loud and clear. As a result of both this threat against his life and in an attempt to appease domestic Zionist Jewish voters and collect Zionist campaign funds, Truman both supported the 1947 partition vote and rushed to recognize Israeli statehood in 1948 against the objections of his diplomatic advisors.
We had several other people in the country, even among the Jews, the Zionists particularly, who were against anything that was to be done if they couldn't have the whole of Palestine and everything handed to them on a silver plate so they wouldn't have to do anything. It couldn't be done. We had to take it in small doses. You can't move 5 or 6 million people out of a country and fill it up with 5 or 6 million more and expect both sets of them to be pleased. We had all sorts of objections to everything that was done. Something had to be done. We went ahead and done it, and had it done, and now it's working out. Eventually, I think we'll have them all satisfied. But it's going to take a great deal of time yet to get the job done.
In fact, it was Abraham Feinberg, the same treasonous lobbyist who later funded Israel's nuclear weapons program and tried to buy JFK's Middle East foreign policy, who would finance Truman's whistle-stop election campaign in 1948. Furthermore, the Zionist president of United Fruit Company, Samuel Zamuri, worked directly with future Israeli president Chaim Weizmann to flagrantly buy UN votes for the November 1947 partition plan. Zamuri asked each leader in the region two questions. How do you intend to vote on partition, and can your vote be changed? Zamuri told Weizmann that every vote from Mexico to Colombia was for sale. Zionists used every trick imaginable to pressure and cajole world leaders. Costa Rica's president, José Figueres, reportedly received a blank checkbook. Haiti was promised economic aid if it would change its original vote opposing partition. Zionist financier and longtime presidential advisor Bernard Baruch told France it would lose U.S. aid if it voted against partition. The wives of Latin American country delegates received mink coats. In the end, all the Zionist threats and bribery resulted in the UN passing the partition plan despite all Arab countries opposing it and with no support from the Palestinians who actually owned Palestine. Thus, the UN vote to partition Palestine was a Zionist-controlled political rubber stamp on the Zionist theft of Palestine. It wasn't a binding vote, just an advisory opinion, but it was used as an excuse to steal the country. Even David Ben-Gurion later admitted that the Zionists had stolen Palestine. Ben-Gurion said in a conversation with Zionist leader Nahum Goldman, quote, "Why should the Arabs make peace? If I was an Arab leader, I would never make terms with Israel. That is natural. We have taken their country. Sure, God promised it to us, but what does that matter to them? Our God is not theirs. We come from Israel. It's true. But 2,000 years ago, and what is that to them? There has been anti-Semitism, the Nazis, Hitler, Auschwitz. But was that their fault? They, the Palestinians, only see one thing. We have come here and stolen their country. Why should they accept that?" End quote. The atrocious historical crime of the partition of Palestine and the theft of the country would eventually have been called into question for JFK if he'd found out about the NUMEC Zionist nuclear weapons smuggling operation. One revelation would have led to more questions and more revelations of Zionist crimes. Had the public found out Israel was stealing nuclear weapons materials from the Pennsylvania plant, Israel at minimum would have been permanently exiled from American halls of power. Ben-Gurion's high hopes were very different than JFK's. In addition to acquiring nuclear weapons, conquering more territory in the Middle East, stopping the return of Palestinian refugees, and preventing AIPAC from being registered as a foreign agent, David Ben-Gurion had another major long-term goal for Israel that could never be accomplished with JFK in the way: the creation of a Jewish Zionist one-world government with Jerusalem as the global capital.
This scenario is borne out by none other than Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, one of the great founders of Israel. Recorded in an astonishing article in Look magazine, Ben-Gurion predicted that a one-world system presided over by Jerusalem will be set up in the near future. All continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished, and there will be no more war. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of Mankind, to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah.
While Ben-Gurion's goal was a Zionist peace in which Israel would conquer and rule the world according to the Torah or Hebrew Bible, also known as the Old Testament, JFK's Christian faith and American ideals informed his vision of a very different kind of peace.
I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
The Kennedy presidency was an existential crisis for Israel on every conceivable level.
Let us move up the steep and difficult path towards comprehensive disarmament, securing mutual confidence through mutual verification, and building the institutions of peace as we dismantle the engines of war.
Israel's back was against the wall. For Israel to survive and achieve all its goals in the 1960s, JFK had to go.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
November 22nd, 1963. The CIA, Israel, Zionists, and a coalition of power elites overthrow the U.S. government. Co-opted Israeli agent James Jesus Angleton, the most powerful man at the CIA at the time, orchestrated the assassination of JFK and the cover-up on behalf of both former CIA Director Alan Dulles and Israel's founding Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. Books such as JFK and the Unspeakable and The Devil's Chessboard name Angleton as a major player in the assassination. What neither book says is that CIA Deputy Director Robert Amory, one of the only honest CIA leaders with honor and integrity, correctly named Angleton to be a co-opted Israeli agent in October 1956. As revealed by another honest CIA agent, Crane Eveland, in his memoir Ropes of Sand, Israel held blackmail power over Alan Dulles, which ensured Angleton could get away with advancing Israel's entire agenda, including the illegal smuggling of nuclear weapons materials out of the U.S. Crane Eveland also says Angleton turned over most of the CIA's Middle East intelligence responsibilities to Israel. Angleton, pictured here with future Mossad director Ephraim Halevi, coordinated CIA-Mossad operations to cover the entire Middle East and Africa. Thus, the Mossad used their Zionist loyalist Angleton to execute a coup of the CIA and take over nearly the entire CIA in the 1950s, long before JFK took office. After Ben-Gurion resigned as Israel's prime minister on June 16, 1963, 5 months before the assassination, Halevi disclosed that Angleton met privately in person with Ben-Gurion to transact business at Ben-Gurion's home in Sidiboker, Israel. With respect to U.S. relations with Israel, Angleton ran a shadow government within the CIA. Angleton's counterintelligence program was a CIA within the CIA, sealed from scrutiny and accountable to no one, yet supported by an almost unlimited budget. Angleton's Israeli partners worked closely with him to prepare for the Dallas coup. The Mossad's Yitzhak Shamir reportedly hired at least one of the JFK assassination team members through a French intelligence contact. The Mossad and Shamir's daughter confirmed Shamir was stationed in Paris during his tenure as director of assassinations.
Paris הייתה מוקד של הפעילות הפעילות המודיעין הישראלית באירופה.
אנחנו ידענו שאנחנו נוסעים לפריז כי אבא עובד אל על.
Shamir ran the Kadon, the ultra-elite team known as the Mossad within the Mossad. Israeli press disclosed that the Mossad hired Adolf Hitler's number one former commando, Otto Skorzeny, for ongoing assassination jobs starting in 1962. H.P. Alberelli reports Otto Skorzeny played a key role in the JFK assassination. Numerous Zionist fingerprints are found all over the Dallas coup and the cover-up. The leader of Israel's Operations Directorate and future Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was in Dallas, Texas on the day of the JFK assassination, according to Rabin's widow. He was allegedly on a military briefing tour. 2 weeks after the assassination, Rabin was promoted to Chief of Staff of the Israeli military. The National Crime Syndicate, which was mostly Zionist and mostly Jewish, played a major role in the assassination. Two different contacts who possess direct knowledge of the incident told me that organized crime boss and Zionist Jew Paul Dorfman angrily pushed Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy up against a concrete column at a Democratic fundraiser in San Francisco at the Sheraton Palace Hotel's Grand Court. Dorfman said to RFK, "Look, you son of a bitch, I put your brother in the White House and I can take him out." In the weeks prior to the JFK assassination, Paul Dorfman's stepson, Alan Dorfman, paid off Jacob Leon Rubenstein, aka Jack Ruby, the Zionist Jewish mobster who was charged with shooting and killing Lee Oswald, Angleton's chosen scapegoat and patsy for the JFK assassination. A paraffin test showed that the entire case against Oswald was a big lie.
But I emphatically deny these charges.
I'd like some legal representation. These police officers have not allowed me to have any. I'm just a patsy.
Not only was Lee Oswald innocent of all charges, he loved President Kennedy and reportedly saved the president's life a few weeks before Dallas by warning about an earlier assassination attempt that was being set up in Chicago for November 2nd, 1963. Former Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden, who was loyal to JFK, is a living witness who testifies that this plot was funded by Israelis.
I do know that in October of 1963, there was another information that was gathered by the Secret Service informant in Chicago that said that the president was about to be assassinated and that it was a done deal, that the money had been put up by Israeli sources.
When Rabbi Hillel Silverman interviewed Jack Ruby in prison, Ruby said, "I did it for the Jewish people." Ruby was a strong supporter of Israel, had traveled to Israel, and had run guns illegally to Israel. The Dorfmans and Jack Ruby were underlings of Meyer Lansky, the Zionist Jewish chairman of the National Crime Syndicate and its infamous assassinations arm, Murder Incorporated. Lansky was the most powerful mobster in the U.S. He was the actual godfather. He played a crucial role running guns to Israel for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and he closely collaborated with CIA leadership on numerous operations, including drug trafficking and assassination plots against Fidel Castro. In 1970, Lansky fled to Israel to escape tax evasion charges. Another CIA agent who was a Zionist Jewish spy loyal to Israel, Reuben Efron, opened Oswald's mail on an ongoing basis before the assassination under Angleton's direction. Pro-Israel Zionist media such as the New York Times played a key role in disseminating Angleton's lone gunman lie, pinning the blame on Oswald.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute.
I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Reserve.
Reserve.
Protect.
Protect.
Defend.
And defend.
Constitution of the United States.
Constitution.
They are the founders and rulers of the usurped states of Zionism and the Central Intelligence Agency. We have lived in the USZCIA empire of lies ever since.
The six-day war in the Middle East between Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and Syria is underway. A spy ship, very lightly armed, but bristling with antennae, steams into the Mediterranean to eavesdrop on the conflict. With the war reaching its climax, Israeli jets and motor torpedo boats launch an unprovoked attack on the ship. They drop napalm and strafe its decks with rockets, cannon fire, and armor-piercing rounds before trying to sink it with torpedoes.
We had no way to defend ourselves,
And it was just, we're just slaughtered.
And they shot up the life rafts that were put into the water, and they shot the ones that were still on board the ship.
Throughout the attack, the ship flies the Stars and Stripes, the flag of the United States of America. Its name, the USS Liberty, is freshly painted on its stern.
If the Israelis had succeeded in sinking the ship without leaving any witnesses or survivors, Egypt would have been accused of the crime, and the United States would have been drawn into the war and sided with Israel.
In a presentation to surviving USS Liberty crewmen, journalist Peter Hounam reports the intended purpose of the Operation Cyanide false flag was to create an excuse and pretext to launch a joint Israeli-U.S. nuclear strike against Egypt. President Nasser of Egypt was squarely in Israel's crosshairs. Multiple countries were on a hair-trigger alert for a global nuclear war.
What happened to you guys on June the 8th, 1967 was actually a seminal moment in world history. And yet the true story has been buried by your government. And the reason is that what happened was so shaming, not just to Israel, but to America too. Only by a hair's breadth did the world avoid a nuclear exchange. The superpowers nearly led us into a third world war. From late 1966 onwards, there were U.S. military personnel, experts, stationed in Tel Aviv, helping with Operation Cyanide and planning for a forthcoming war against Egypt. In other words, it wasn't to defend Israel from an attack by Egypt. It was to promote an attack by Israel on Egypt. Their objective was to launch an invasion of Jordan and grab territory in the West Bank and the old city of Jerusalem, which was considered historical areas of the Jews. By the time the Liberty reached its position close to the Egyptian coast, Israel had conquered the Sinai. Its troops were close to the Suez Canal. Underneath the Liberty, there was a Polaris submarine, the USS Andrew Jackson, which had followed your ship all the way from Spain. But remember, a submarine like that has only one purpose, and that is to strike against an enemy with nuclear weapons in the event of a nuclear war. As the attack unfolded and the Sixth Fleet got a message from the Liberty that you were being attacked, instead of sending planes to your rescue, they started a counterattack on Cairo. Nuclear-armed planes were dispatched from the USS America, a huge aircraft carrier, to bomb Cairo. So these planes launched from the USS America reached within 3 minutes of dropping these nuclear weapons on Cairo. We know that from several sources. They were well over Egyptian territory when an order came through for them to urgently return to base. A panic-stricken Robert McNamara and his president, Lyndon Johnson, came on the line and ordered the recall. Altogether, 50 planes were dispatched towards Egypt. And after their recall, every one had to be counted in. It is reminiscent of Dr. Strangelove. Added to this, a powerful amphibious landing force was dispatched to land near El Alamein, and you could only assume that they were due to head for Cairo too. When it had to be recalled, it was clear the mission was a fiasco. But of course, it was also an outrage, because Egypt had not conducted the attack on the Liberty, it was the Israelis. It's quite well known now that Israel had been attempting to complete its first nuclear weapon at Dimona, their secret nuclear weapons plant, in the Negev Desert. By the summer of 1967, the CIA had intelligence that a bomb was near completion. As your ship neared its position, I now can say that this nuclear weapon was ready to be detonated. You were going to be in the fallout zone of where the bomb was going to go off. And it nearly did go off. There were teams in Israel ready to fly in helicopters with this device and detonate it in place. It was a suicide mission because they didn't have timing mechanisms for the bomb. They had to run a very long wire, nearly a mile, to a detonator and set it off themselves. And of course, being a mile from a bomb like that was likely to end in their deaths. Again, it's got shades of Dr. Strangelove. One of the brave volunteers who was due to go on the mission and spoken to me in detail, and he had something to say. This man understood that the bomb was going to be detonated on a mountain in the Sinai Desert. The operation to place a bomb in Egypt was called Operation Samson, which indicates it was a sort of suicide mission, a last-ditch measure. And some of these people have indicated that the Americans knew about it, that they knew what Israel was up to. We must consider whether this was another reason why USS Liberty was sent close to the proposed blast area, or is it just a bizarre coincidence? I doubt it. It is no exaggeration to say that we were close to World War III. America's Strategic Air Command was controlled from a huge underground nerve center in Arizona. Its role was to launch a nuclear blitzkrieg on Russia and China. Its primary means of doing that were B-52 nuclear-armed bombers. Before the Liberty attack, these bombers were put on high alert. I interviewed a pilot of a B-52 who was on high alert in California, and he was placed in that position before the Liberty attack. We also know that in Arizona, at SAC headquarters, similar measures were in place. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the involvement of the SAC suggests that other countries should well have known what was going on, because launching a nuclear war involved NATO. And the involvement of SAC suggests America and Israel were not the only countries that might have been involved in events of that period. SAC was, of course, hooked into NATO, which was based in Europe. NATO was led by an American General Lemnitzer, who also had a second job, which was being in charge of U.S. forces in Europe, including the Mediterranean. These countries, members of NATO, probably knew something about this emergency and are also holding secrets about the Six-Day War. Britain was in a perfect position to keep an eye on what was going on. It had amazing electronic listening facilities in Cyprus. One crucial piece of evidence came to me recently, and that is that a squadron of Lightning aircraft, which were trained and designed to counter a Soviet nuclear attack, were on high alert in Cyprus for the whole duration of the Six-Day War. So what did Britain know about the Six-Day War that they've never told us about? Further supporting evidence is that British intelligence agents were working alongside American personnel in Israel as part of Operation Sinai in 1966, planning the war against Egypt. How do I know this? I have interviewed people who were there who confirm it. This is such a complex story. It is understandable we are still searching for answers. But even after more than 50 years, it is vitally important that we keep searching, not just from a historical perspective, but because it still has a bearing on modern world problems, not least the Palestinian problem. I want to end with another story. In the early 60s, long before the Six-Day War, a plan called Operation Northwoods was drawn up by the Pentagon. The idea was to blacken the character of Fidel Castro, label the country Cuba as an aggressor, and create a casus belli, a justification for America launching an attack on the country. When Operation Northwoods was brought to Kennedy in the Oval Office, he was horrified. It had numerous black ops that he strongly disapproved of. The man who brought that plan to him was General Lyman Lemnitzer, the guy who was in charge of U.S. forces in Europe during the Six-Day War. Kennedy was so furious that within months he had Lemnitzer dispatched to Europe. He considered him to be a highly dangerous man. He was a hawk, virulently anti-communist, and prepared to do almost anything to get rid of the Soviet Union, including launch a nuclear war. The Northwoods plan proposed many provocations, but one in particular is relevant. It recommended that an American ship should be sailed into Havana Harbor, where it would blow up. This would then be blamed on Cuba, giving an excuse to America to invade. The idea, as far as the Joint Chiefs of Staff were concerned, and Lemnitzer in particular, the use of nukes were not on the agenda in that eventuality. We therefore must ask whether the attack on the Liberty was modeled on these sort of dirty tricks tactics, because they are so similar in terms of the detail. You only have to see what has been happening in Gaza in the last month to see that what happened in the Six-Day War has had ramifications all through the decades. The plight of the Palestinians is still the same. The story has not yet ended.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I run for the presidency because I want the Democratic Party and the United States of America to stand for hope instead of despair, for reconciliation of men instead of the growing risk of world war.
Robert Kennedy had infuriated Zionist leaders by supporting an investigation aimed at registering the American Zionist Council as a foreign agent, which would have considerably hindered its efficiency. After the assassination of John Kennedy, the American Zionist Council escaped this procedure, and its lobbying division, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, became the most powerful lobby in the United States and an indispensable instrument for the corruption and intimidation of American elected officials and for the control of American foreign policy.
When he ran for president in 1968, Senator Kennedy planned to reopen the investigation into JFK's assassination, which would have exposed both the CIA and Israel's role, as well as their collaboration with LBJ in the false flag attack on the USS Liberty in 1967.
They had no other option but to stop him.
What has been going on within the United States over the period of the last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, we can start to work together. We are a great country and a compassionate country, and I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of next year. Now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m.
The CIA and Zionists chose to falsely blame the assassination of Robert Kennedy on Palestinian American Sirhan Sirhan, who could not possibly have fired the fatal shots that killed RFK. They selected Sirhan as their brainwashed scapegoat in order to stir up hatred and loathing of Palestinians and increase American support for Israel. Zionist fingerprints are once again found on the RFK assassination. James Jesus Angleton reportedly kept RFK autopsy photos in his safe as if they were some sort of memento or trophy. Both Lisa Peace and David Talbot named CIA agent Robert Mayhew as the orchestrator of the RFK assassination. Mayhew's close friend and notorious Zionist gunrunner, Hank Greenspun, bylined preposterous false trail stories in his Las Vegas Sun newspaper, claiming that Fidel Castro was responsible for both Kennedy assassinations. Yet another lie in Angleton's wilderness of mirrors.
He called me up one night and he said, I've been thinking a lot about great men. It occurs to me that it would be kind of a cakewalk for me to become a great man. I mean, everybody expects me to be a great man. I'm perfectly positioned. I can just do it. And he said, but I've been reading a lot of biographies of great men all the way through history. And I'm realizing that not one of them seems to have been a good guy at home. And I wonder if it wouldn't be a much more interesting challenge in my position to set out at this point and see if I couldn't make myself a good man.
JFK Jr. was widely known to be planning to run for office, most likely for Senate, in November of 2000. The CIA and the Mossad couldn't let him anywhere near elected office because he would obviously make it his unyielding mission to uncover the full truth about the assassinations of his uncle and his father. JFK Jr. published an issue of George magazine focused on analyzing conspiracies. One of the stories Kennedy published indicated an Israeli intelligence role in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli prime minister who had softened his attitude toward the Palestinians. Netanyahu also had played an obvious and very public role in the Rabin assassination. The Mossad could not tolerate a high-profile Kennedy digging up dirt on Israel, which, if it had been exposed at that time, could possibly have caused a near disintegration of Israeli society.
Four eyewitnesses at Caldwell Airport saw former President George H.W. Bush and his son, Texas Governor George W. Bush, with two members of the Mossad, Michael Harari and General Rafael Eltan, the day before the tragic flight.
Good evening. Divers today found the bodies of John Kennedy, his wife and her sister, in the wreckage of his plane at the bottom of the ocean off Martha's Vineyard. In a day of fast-breaking developments, recovery teams got to work retrieving remains and wreckage. A memorial mass was set for Friday in New York. The President and the First Lady will be there. And the Kennedy family made plans for a possible burial at sea.
Less than 2 months before the JFK Jr. assassination, CBS, which is a CIA and Zionist affiliate, published a story about his father's coffin being dumped at sea, which was likely predictive programming and an announcement about what they planned to do to JFK Jr. The humiliation ritual was clear in the claim that Bobby Kennedy wanted his brother's coffin dumped at sea, and Bobby would have wanted to retain all physical evidence related to the crime in order to eventually prove that there was, in fact, a vast conspiracy.
In the next instant, with this time Mrs. Kennedy apparently looking on, a second shot, the third total shot, hit the president's head. His head could be seen to move violently forward.
We will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false, CIA Director William Casey said in February 1981.
We talked for a long time on the phone about 2 weeks before he died. I said, "You remember that conversation we had about being a good man?" And he said, "Of course, I think about it a lot." And I said, "Well, I just want you to know that you have wildly, spectacularly achieved that objective. I mean, you are as good a man as I know. You are as clear a case of what I consider to be virtue in an adult male that I can think of."
The cabal had to take him out, both to keep the secrets of their past crimes hidden and make sure JFK Jr. was not in a position of power to disrupt future crimes, such as 9/11.
What happened in 1977 was that Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, the former heads of the Zionist terrorist gang, the Irgun, and Lehi, the Stern Gang, these two parties had created a coalition of all their former terrorist buddies. And Netanyahu's in there, the revisionist Zionists, they came to power in Israel. And this is when the plan for 9/11 began. Menachem Begin is known as the father of terrorism. He's the founder of the Likud party. He was born in Russia, came to Palestine in 42, became leader of the Irgun in 44, which was a terrorist group, bombed the King David Hotel, killing 93 people, British headquarters in 1946, then was involved in the massacre of the Deir Yassin village, which was meant to scare the Palestinians to fleeing, which many did. And he created the Likud party in 1973, became prime minister in 77, and promptly invaded Lebanon in 1978. This is the emblem of the Irgun, which he was the head of. It's a Jewish terrorist group. And it's connected to the Netanyahu family because Mr. Netanyahu's father was the director of this movement, the Irgun, the new Zionist organization, since 1940. Here is both Mr. Begin and Netanyahu. These men are cut from the same cloth. This is the group that they belong to. The great group that they have allegiance to is a group of terrorists. In 1974, a British journalist asked Mr. Begin, he said, how does it feel in the light of all that's going on to be seen as the father of terrorism in the Middle East? And Begin said, in the Middle East? He said, in all the world. So he put on himself the mantle of being the father of terrorism in all the world. And in 1979, this man, Bibi Netanyahu, he'd been working in Boston for a Rothschild company called Boston Consulting Group. He went back, this is his father, and they started something called the Netanyahu Institute, in which they began promoting the idea of terrorism being the scourge that the West has to fight. And they had a conference in 1979 called the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism. And George Bush spoke at the conference and spoke in support of this preemptive strikes against nations that are supporting terrorism.
On September 23, 1979, less than 3 months after the Jerusalem Conference, which was actually the International Conference of Terrorism, Israel's founding spymaster and former Mossad chief Isser Harel predicted that Arabs would attack the tallest building in New York City.
He made that prediction to this man, Michael Evans, a Zionist Jewish Christian evangelist from Texas. That was 20 years before 9/11. Mr. Evans said, do you think that terrorism will come to America? And if so, where and why? Now, this is 1979. Harel said, I fear it will come to you in America. America has the power but not the will to fight terrorism. As to the where, Harel said, New York City is a symbol of freedom and capitalism. It's likely they will attack, they will strike the Empire State Building, your tallest building, and symbol of your power. He pretended to be ignorant about the tallest building.
Following the conference, Benjamin Netanyahu made a career promoting the so-called war on terrorism, and he somehow also predicted 9/11.
I wrote a book in 1995, and I said that if the West doesn't wake up to the suicidal nature of militant Islam, the next thing you'll see is the militant Islam is bringing down the World Trade Center.
9/11 was a false flag terror atrocity that was designed to instill fear and rage in the American population, so that we would accept and we would get behind this war on terror. And I have to say, it succeeded very well.
I have had long conversations over the past 2 weeks with contacts at the Army War College, at its headquarters, Marine Corps, and I've made it absolutely clear in both cases that it is 100% certain that 9/11 was a Mossad operation, period.
Mm-hmm.
They did 9/11. They did it.
One of the clues to Israel's involvement in the 9/11 attacks is the behavior of a group of individuals known as the Dancing Israelis. They were seen by various witnesses standing on the roof of a van bearing the Urban Moving Systems logo and parked in Jersey City. They were rejoicing and taking pictures of themselves just as the first plane hit the North Tower.
And I could see that they were, like, happy. You know, they didn't look shocked to me.
According to ABC's 2020, when the van belonging to the cheering Israelis was stopped by the police, the driver of the van, Savan Kurtzberg, told the officers,
"We are Israelis. We are not your problem. Your problems are our problems. The Palestinians are your problem."
Why did he feel that the Palestinians were a problem for the NYPD?
The five Dancing Israelis were held for a total of 71 days in a Brooklyn jail before being quietly returned to Israel on the inconsequential charge of visa violation. Three of them were later invited to an Israeli TV show in November 2001, where one of them stated, "Our purpose was to document the event."
Our purpose was to document the event.
Which implies prior knowledge of the event.
And word late tonight that two suspects are in FBI custody after a truckload of explosives was discovered around the George Washington Bridge. That bridge links New York to New Jersey over the Hudson River. The FBI has two suspects in hand, said the truck, enough explosives were in the truck to do great damage to the George Washington Bridge.
Here's what the Jerusalem Post reported on 12th September 2001. Authorities suspect the terrorists intended to blow up the main crossing between New Jersey and New York. At least two of the detained Israelis were agents working for the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. and that Urban Moving Systems, the ostensible employer of the five Israelis, was a front operation. This was confirmed by two former CIA officers, and they noted that movers' vans are a common intelligence cover.
The five dancing Israelis are just the tip of a vast iceberg. In September 2001, federal law enforcement was busy dismantling the largest Israeli spy ring ever discovered on American soil.
Since September 11th, more than 60 Israelis have been arrested or detained, either under the new Patriot Anti-Terrorism Law or for immigration violations. A handful of active Israeli military were among those detained, according to investigators, who say some of the detainees also failed polygraph questions when asked about alleged surveillance activities against and in the United States.
None of these leads were thoroughly investigated. The reason is that in 2001, the head of the Justice Department's criminal division was Michael Chertoff, the son of a rabbi and a Mossad agent. All Israeli spies arrested by the FBI, including the dancing Israelis, owe him their impunity and repatriation to Israel. Chertoff is a key man in the 9/11 operation.
Quote, there was no question but that the order to close down the investigation came from the White House. It was immediately assumed at CIA headquarters that this basically was going to be a cover-up so that the Israelis would not be implicated in any way in 9/11.
9/11 was a policy coup that brought us a global war on terror and a series of disastrous wars across the region.
What happened in 9/11 is we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have bipartisan agreement, we didn't have American understanding of it, and we had instead a policy coup in this country, a coup, a policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us.
They call it the Long War. The War on Terror is a suitable title because the War on Terror is the longest and most expensive war, foreign war, in U.S. history.
Turning 9/11 into an excuse for Israel to use its U.S. battering ram to take out Israeli targets was a long-term plan.
As far back as 1990, when Netanyahu served as Israel's deputy foreign minister, he claimed Iraq had a nuclear program that was, quote, fast accelerating. In an interview on NBC News Today show in December 1990, Netanyahu warned of what he called Saddam Hussein's, quote, weapons of destruction.
The question is really, how do we ensure that these weapons of destruction, these missiles, these chemical weapons, the nuclear program that is fast accelerating in Iraq, that these do not pose a threat? This is an issue for the entire international community.
Netanyahu's weapons of mass destruction lies were even more extreme a decade later.
There is no question whatsoever that Saddam is seeking and is working and is advancing towards the development of nuclear weapons. No question whatsoever.
Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction.
No one can seem to prove to this point that Iraq poses an imminent threat to this country or to any other nation.
Do you believe that action can be taken against Saddam only after he builds nuclear bombs and uses them?
The U.S. administration recently admitted, after months and months of talk, that there's no evidence of Iraq being tied to September 11th.
And do the various critics, especially overseas, believe that a clear connection between Saddam and September 11th must be established before we have a right to prevent the next September 11th? Well, I think not.
An Israeli think tank concocted the 2003 Iraq War all the way back in 1996. In a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm, Israeli neoconservatives proposed both removing Saddam Hussein from power and weakening Syria. Clean break co-authors such as Richard Perl and other Israel loyal neocons such as Paul Wolfowitz and Elliot Abrams played leading roles in the Project for a New American Century. The think tank's Rebuilding America's Defenses white paper, published in September of 2000, called for a new Pearl Harbor as a casus belli for a series of U.S. wars mostly on behalf of Israel. By way of deception, Israel and the Mossad did war with the new Pearl Harbor and executed a controlled demolition of American sanity.
The Zionist neocons had called for a new Pearl Harbor in order to effect the change they needed to see.
Israel loyal neocon and Clean Break co-author Douglas Feith, who also served as the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense, was the architect of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. Another Israel loyal neocon and Clean Break co-author, David Wormser, wrote a memo several days after 9/11 stating the U.S. should hit, quote, a non-Al-Qaeda target such as Iraq, end quote. Many of the neocons hold dual U.S.-Israeli citizenship, and they are primarily loyal to Israel. Their project for a new American century was more accurately the project for a new Zionist century.
So what they needed is the United States military to come in and to basically fight their wars for them.
Right after 9/11, about 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, sir, you got to come in and talk to me a second. He says, we've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq. Why? He said, I don't know. I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
The War on Terror is not just a name, it's authorization, it's a title, it's authorization and funding, and it was passed 3 days after 9/11 by the authorization to use military force, which basically gave the president the authority to wage war against anybody he thought was behind 9/11. So these are some of the places where the authorization to use military force has been invoked. Was Eritrea? Was Somalia? Were they involved in 9/11? Was Libya involved in 9/11? Are all these countries involved in 9/11? No, of course they're not. But the authorization to use military force based on 9/11 crime has opened up the Pandora's box for American open-ended war fighting across the Middle East, around the world, actually. The fraudulent war on terror is based on the official myth of
9/11.
Quote, I know what America is. America is something that can easily be moved to the right direction. They won't get in our way. 80% of Americans support us. It's absurd, end quote. Netanyahu, king of Israel. He didn't know he was being recorded. In the run-up to 9/11, Netanyahu had help preparing to move America from friends such as Larry Silverstein, a wealthy Zionist backer of the Israel Bonds program that supports Israeli apartheid and human rights abuses. Netanyahu and Silverstein were so close, they spoke every Sunday afternoon.
I had the pleasure of working pretty much with every Prime Minister of Israel, from Yitzhak Shamir forward. I said to myself, wouldn't it be fantastic if I could own the Twin Towers? We got very, very lucky. The governor of New York, George Pataki, decided one day that maybe it would be good to privatize the ownership
of the World Trade Center. So I got a call from the governor's office, and they said, would you ever consider owning the World Trade Center? It was very, very good for the family, very good for us, and we were very, very fortunate. On the morning of 9/11, I'm getting ready, getting dressed to go to the dermatologist. I have light colored hair, light skin. The sun is a disaster for me. I can't take the sun. She said, okay, but you're going to the dermatologist. You're going this morning and you're not going downtown. We got very, very lucky. And I had an obligation to collect the insurance proceeds from the policies. A new governor was just elected, Elliot Spitzer, an old friend who I knew well. And I said, Elliot, if you don't help me, I'll never collect from the insurance companies. And guess what? He listened and he said, you know what? You're entitled. I'm going to get you the money. And in 6 months, he got me the $4.5 billion. We got very, very lucky.
Here's Colin Powell at the UN spreading Israeli Mossad and CIA lies that tricked and scared large segments of U.S. and Western public opinion into supporting the illegal and immoral invasion of Iraq.
For example, they can produce anthrax and botulinum toxin. In fact, they can produce enough dry biological agent in a single month to kill thousands upon thousands of people. And dry agent of this type is the most lethal form for human beings. Iraq has mobile biological research laboratories in addition to the production facilities I mentioned earlier.
Who were the sources of Colin Powell's scary story about non-existent Iraqi weapons of mass destruction? One of them was criminal Zionist propagandist Judith Miller, who ginned up multiple stories claiming Iraq had WMDs for the New York Times. The New York Times is a dedicated Zionist propaganda vehicle well known for its unbroken track record of printing completely false and or distorted information about Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East for decades to advance Israel's interests. A more accurate name for this publication would be the New U.S. ZCIA Lies, or the New Zionist Lies. Judith Miller was deeply connected with Zionist neocon Louis Scooter Libby, who was both an attorney for Mossad agent Mark Rich and the chief of staff to Dick Cheney. Scooter Libby, who Slate magazine called the most significant intellectual influence behind the invasion of Iraq, also delivered to Colin Powell fraudulent reports claiming Iraq was an imminent threat to the U.S. and Saddam Hussein was linked to 9/11. In his memoir, Colin Powell castigated both Louis Libby's false reports about Iraq as well as the CIA for providing totally inaccurate information that Powell used in his UN presentation.
As the world knows, no weapons of mass destruction were ever found. There were none. If we had known there were no weapons of mass destruction, there would have been no war.
Now, what's going on here is that an Israeli plan known as the Yenon Plan, which was articulated in 1982, is being put into effect so that countries are being balkanized. That is, they're being broken up into ethnic statelets. You're causing friction between the various ethnic groups, breaking them up into ethnic statelets. That's the name of the game in Syria. That's what they did in Iraq. That's what's happened in Libya, etc. This is the Israeli plan to dominate the Middle East by breaking up the large Arab states and breaking up their armies and breaking the countries into pieces like Yugoslavia. There will be no competition for Israel, and Israel will have hegemony over the entire region.
If you take out Saddam,
Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region.
Oded Yanon's 1982 Zionist plan for the Middle East is in large part taking shape. Is this coincidence? Was Yanon a psychic? We in the West are victims of a long-held agenda, not of our making, and without a doubt not in our interest. We're waging war for another entity, for another nation, for another interest that's not ours. And we're paying for it. Our sons and daughters are fighting it. And this is the partition of Palestine. When it happened in 1947, Menachem Begin rejected it.
We had several other people in the country, even among the Jews, the Zionists particularly, who were against anything that was to be done if they couldn't have the whole of Palestine and everything handed to them on a silver plate so they wouldn't have to do anything. It couldn't be done. We had to take it in small doses. You can't move 5 or 6 million people out of a country and fill it up with 5 or 6 million more and expect both sets of them to be pleased.
He said, Jerusalem was and will forever be our capital. And Eretz Israel will be restored to the people of Israel. All of it and forever. This is to give you an idea what Eretz Israel means. It means the land of Israel. And according to people like Menachem Begin, it extends from the Nile River to the Euphrates. And this area right here is the Kurdish area, which happens to be occupied by the United States. This is all Syria right here. This is where the United States is occupying one-third of Syria. These are the various ethnic communities, religions, factions in Iraq and Syria. And from the Yanon plan, Yanon said the dissolution of Syria and Iraq is Israel's primary target on the Eastern Front. The dissolution of the military power of these states serves as the primary short-term target.
We had all sorts of objections to everything that was done. Something had to be done. We went ahead and done it, and had it done, and now it's working out. Eventually, I think we'll have them all satisfied. But it's going to take a great deal of time yet to get the job done.
This is exactly what we did. When we went to Iraq, first in 1991 and then again in 2003, we destroyed the Iraqi military. If you remember, one of the first things that happened is when we got into Iraq, we disbanded the entire military, sent everybody home, no more jobs, no entitlements, nothing. So the military went away. And in Syria, we've been trying to do the same thing for the last 7 years. Now, this is another break area here, Periwinkle, is the area of the Kurds. And this area is where most of the oil is. And the United States and Israel are supporting the Kurdish independence, this area here in northern Iraq and this part of northern Syria. And in pursuing that, the largest holder of the reserves in this Kurdistan area of Iraq is a company called Genel Energy, which is a Rothschild company. So they're going after the strategic assets. And these two cities, Mosul and Raqqa, were targets of the American anti-terrorist attacks last summer, which destroyed those cities, destroyed them. Here's Mosul in June of 2017, the great mosque of al-Nuri, destroyed in the Battle of Mosul. The Americans, we put our artillery around the cities and just pounded them for months. And that has a price. Here's Syria, the other city in Raqqa, in Syria, October 2017. At least half the city is totally destroyed. We said we were fighting ISIS, but under the pretext of fighting ISIS, we destroyed the cities. ISIS is the target, and they put that target wherever they want, and then destroy everything around the target.
From the Jordan River to the Middle East, that's all ours. It was promised to us.
1 week before, the World Trade Center, those two great edifices of tremendous architecture, they were destroyed, I mean, in such a way that nobody still understands what happened. How come they were brought down in such a massive way? 1 week before, one of the great rabbis in Israel, a Hasidic rabbi, an Admor, he came to visit with some people, some of his disciples in the car. They prayed Mincha with Minyan in front of everybody passing in Manhattan. Where? Right there, near the World Center. After he finished the davening, the prayer, he said, say bye-bye to those buildings because you are not going to see them no more. I mean, it's unbelievable. There will be two big buildings in the land of Edom, which today we relate the word Edom to America. And those are the biggest, the tallest buildings in the world. And they will be totally, they will be brought down completely. And that will be the sign of the beginning of tremendous wars that will end only in the coming of the Mashiach. He said, say bye-bye to those buildings because you are not going to see them no more. I mean, it's unbelievable.
one or the other.
I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
The decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq.
Biden just reclassified the Kennedy document 60 years after his assassination. Why in the world would we be continuing to hide the truth about the Kennedy assassination 60 years later? And of course, the answer is obvious, because it implicates not individuals, but institutions, and reveals them as complicit in a murder and in the overthrow of the U.S. government. And the U.S. government is complicit in the overthrow of the U.S. government. And that's the truth. I know that for a fact, because I interviewed someone who saw the documents.
We spoke to someone who had access to these still hidden CIA documents, a person who was deeply familiar with what they contain. We asked this person directly, did the CIA have a hand in the murder of John F. Kennedy, an American president? And here's the reply we received verbatim. Quote, the answer is yes. I believe they were involved. It's a whole different country from what we thought it was. It's all fake.
Secrecy is incompatible with democracy. That's not democracy. It's something else. And don't insult me by calling it a democracy, because it's very much not. In the United States, we have over a billion federal documents that remain classified. A billion. So that's a democracy? That is not a democracy.
In JFK's famous speech warning about the nefarious power of secret societies, Kennedy likely gave us a coded warning about Israel's ultimate goal of global domination. He must have known about this plan, because prior to becoming president, JFK had multiple private meetings with Benjamin Friedman, a former Zionist Jew who became Christian and attempted to warn members of the government about the ultimate Zionist ambition.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. Today, no war has been declared. And however fierce the struggle may be, it may never be declared in the traditional fashion. Our way of life is under attack. Those who make themselves our enemy are advancing around the globe. The survival of our friends is in danger. And yet no war has been declared. No borders have been crossed by marching troops. No missiles have been fired.
The Mossad's Sayanim, or covert Zionist helper agents, constitutes exactly the kind of secret society JFK warned against. Every word of his speech applies to the Mossad Sayanim.
The Sayanim are 10 of thousands of people, Jews, Zionists, who are member probably of the Bnei Brit, for instance. Bnei Brit is the Jewish masonry, who occupy high level in all the societies. I mean, you can imagine 5,000 Zionim in New York, only in the business area. 5,000 Zionim in Los Angeles, in the production area, in the artistic area. And in France, in London, you can imagine 1,000 Zionim in the medias. And they receive orders from the Mossad, from a department of the Mossad called the War Department. All these people who have their work, who work normally, they are citizens. I mean, they work in a bank, they are political, they are publishers. But when the Mossad call them and tell them, look, I need information. I need, for instance, I need that all the Sayanim all over the world say that this person, for instance, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has said something anti-Semitic. And you see all over the world, in Europe, in New York, the medias, you have the impression, I mean, when I discovered that, I understood, because suddenly, you open a newspaper, you listen to a radio, you hear a politician, everybody says, the Secretary General of the United States said something anti-Semitic. I mean, the poor guy. And why? Because the Mossad gave the order to do that.
If anything, Cohen understates the power of the Mossad Sayanim. Some of them are assassins who obviously have been tasked in the past with eliminating those who expose Zionist crimes. The Sayanim appear to be a precise implementation of the protocols of the Elders of Zion in order to, quote, place our agents and helpers everywhere, end quote, to advance the Jewish Zionist conquest of the world that David Ben-Gurion referenced in Look magazine. Journalist Christopher Berlin has stated his belief that the protocols of the Elders of Zion are likely meeting notes from a B'nai B'rith chapter. Everyone alive today should read the protocols of the Elders of Zion, given that the Zionist-Israeli-Jewish conquest of the world, which is now entering its endgame, seems to fit that document accurately. Another protocol the Zionist movement has used very effectively in its quest to dominate the world is blackmail. Epstein Island was a Mossad blackmail operation, and recently it was reported that the Mossad blackmailed Bill Clinton using Monica Lewinsky.
We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know.
Within the U.S. government, there are forces wholly beyond democratic control. These forces are more powerful than the elected officials that supposedly oversee them. These forces can affect election outcomes. They can even hide their complicity in the murder of an American president. In other words, they can do pretty much anything they want. They constitute a government within a government, mocking by their very existence the idea of democracy.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed.
In my last conversation with President Trump in the White House, he called me a lot. And this is after January 6th, so it's 2 weeks before, or a week before he's leaving office. I said, how you doing? He said, not too well. And he went off into a tangent about what he thought happened with the election. I said, you know, you made a promise to the public many times and to me privately that you haven't kept. What? I'll take care of it right now. I said, you promised you would release the records of the JFK assassination. He said to me, Judge, if they showed you what they showed me, you wouldn't have released it either. And I said, who's they and what did they show you? And then he said, Judge, someday when we're on the phone, and then he raised his voice, and there aren't 15 people listening to the phone call, back to a normal voice, I'll tell you.
Oh, my God.
I mean, this makes it sound even worse. Who are they? Probably somebody in the intelligence community. What did they show him? JFK's brains blown out?
The actual reason the CIA has insisted every puppet president illegally withhold the full JFK assassination files is if our criminal Zionist regime ever disclosed the truth that Israel and the CIA killed JFK, the entire U.S. ZCIA regime and its relationship with genocidal Israel would be completely delegitimized. The public would demand the declassification of all 1 billion classified documents held by the illegitimate U.S. ZCIA regime, which would obviously reveal decades of atrocious crimes.
This is it. You know, it was said by one person that after the Kennedy assassination, there has been no president. They have only been factotums of the system since then.
Factotum, a handyman or servant employed to do all kinds of work around the house, an employee or official having many different responsibilities.
And it may well be the most decisive event in modern American history.
Jeffrey Sachs is correct. We have had no legitimate president since November 22, 1963. All have been servants of Israel and the CIA. If any tried to exercise meaningful independent judgment, as Jimmy Carter attempted, the cabal removed them from office. Virtually every election has been a choice between one Zionist puppet such as Biden and another Zionist puppet such as Trump. Israel has the ability to buy elections outright or even rig the elections in collaboration with the CIA. As Monica Wiesack wrote in her book, JFK was America's last president.
Incidentally, I had dinner with Mike Pompeo, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, and he said something really interesting to me.
You had dinner with Mike Pompeo
in Las Vegas? He turned to me and like looked me dead in the eye, and he said, the entire upper echelon of that agency is made up of individuals who do not believe in the democratic institutions of the United States of America. That's a quote.
So it was Mike Pompeo who convinced Trump not to release the file. And it was a guy who worked for Mike Pompeo texted me the day after I revealed that those files showed CIA complicity in your uncle's death, which they do, because I talked to someone who read them. And I said that on Fox News, and I got a text from a guy who works for Mike Pompeo informing me that I had just broken federal law, and that anyone who had told me that was a felon because we had revealed classified information. And I said, wait a second, that classified information suggests the U.S. government was involved in the murder of an American president. Yeah, that's Mike Pompeo's position on that.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit weird for him to say. And he was also behind keeping convincing Trump not to pardon Assange.
Actually, Mike Pompeo plotted to assassinate journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
Yeah, well, you know, that confirms my earlier assessment of Mike Pompeo.
Makes me wonder, are we just a shell company for Israel? Just a shell company for Israel? Just a shell company for Israel?
Israel is not a colony of America, whose leaders serve at the pleasure of the party in power in Washington.
In reality, the opposite is true. U.S. puppet politicians serve at the pleasure of Israel and the CIA, which is mostly a Mossad field station. How powerful is AIPAC, the Israeli lobby that fervently supports Israel's genocidal goals and dictates U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East? In an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, the Zionist propagandist-in-chief of The Atlantic, former AIPAC official and Israeli super spy Stephen Rosen made it crystal clear who actually runs the U.S. government.
My name is Steve Rosen. For 2.5 decades, I was a senior official of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Rosen said, "You see this napkin? In 24 hours, we could have the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin."
If you went back to 1948 and you had two alternative futures, one with a state of Israel and one without a state of Israel, the United States, from a security point of view, would be much better off without Israel.
In point of fact, all aid to Israel is actually illegal. Senator Stuart Symington successfully sponsored and passed legislation in 1976 outlawing all military and economic aid to undeclared nuclear weapon powers such as Israel. At the behest of their AIPAC puppet masters, the U.S. Congress has ignored the Symington Amendment for nearly half a century and has pretended that Israel doesn't even have nuclear weapons. At the 1960 Democratic Convention, Symington was JFK's original choice to be vice president before Zionists muscled him out and used blackmail to replace him with their puppet LBJ, setting the stage for the 1963 Dallas coup. Christopher Berlin reports that Chicago's Zionist political machine chieftain, Jacob Arvey, led the blackmail operation to put LBJ onto the ticket, and in so doing, Zionists took advantage of JFK as a Trojan horse to get LBJ into the White House. If JFK and RFK had succeeded in forcing AIPAC to register as the agent of a foreign government, which it obviously is, the U.S. might today be an independent country and not a Zionist colony of Israel.
If this capital crumbled to the ground, the one thing that would remain is our commitment to our aid, and I don't even call it aid, our cooperation with Israel.
I think that by now it is very clear to many of us, including the Israeli leadership, that Washington is Israel's most subservient colony.
We live in an occupied government right now. We live in a government that's occupied, our nation's occupied, and trying to work within this occupied government for 9/11 truth when the whole deck is stacked against you is very difficult.
Israel is no ally. Also, it is actually not a friend. If the United States goes to war with Iran, it will not be because Tehran actually threatens America. It will be because Israel and its powerful lobby in the U.S. have succeeded in creating an essentially false casus belli to mandate such action. Israel interferes in American elections. It has corrupted our Congress. Its head of government publicly rebukes our own head of state. Its intelligence officers actually provide alarmist and inaccurate private briefings for American senators on Capitol Hill. One other very good reason why Israel should not receive billions of dollars in military assistance annually is its persistent espionage against the United States. Friends of Israel stole enriched uranium from a Pennsylvania refinery to create a nuclear arsenal. Arnon Milchan, a Hollywood producer born in Israel, arranged for the illegal purchase of 800 nuclear triggers.
Israeli arms dealer, super spy, and nuclear weapons trigger smuggler Arnon Milchan was the executive producer and chief financier of Oliver Stone's JFK film, which made no mention of Israel's nuclear weapons program and did not examine Israel's multiple motivations to remove JFK and replace him with Zionist loyalist LBJ. From Israel's perspective, solely blaming the CIA and the U.S. military establishment for the assassination of JFK is a convenient half-truth that shields Israel from scrutiny.
Someday, somewhere, someone may find out the damn truth. We better.
Israeli super spy Arnon Milchan also produced three Hollywood productions that foreshadowed Operation 9/11, The Medusa Touch in 1976, which featured an airplane crashing into a skyscraper, Fight Club in 1999, with multiple controlled demolitions of financial district skyscrapers, and the pilot episode of The Lone Gunman, first aired March 4th, 2001, in which hijackers attempt to fly an airplane into the World Trade Center using remote-controlled autopilot.
Israel, which relies on Washington for political cover and international fora like the UN, does not spy discreetly, largely because it knows that few in Washington will seek to hold it to account. There were, for example, no consequences for the Israelis when Israeli Mossad intelligence officers, using passports and pretending to be Americans, recruited terrorists to carry out attacks inside Iran. Israelis using U.S. passports in that fashion put every American traveler at risk. Israel has obtained significant advantage by systematically stealing American technology with both military and civilian applications. The U.S. developed technology is then reverse engineered and used by the Israelis to support their own exports. A General Accounting Office examination of espionage directed against American defense and security industries described how Israeli citizens residing in the U.S. had stolen sensitive technology to manufacture artillery gun tubes, obtain classified plans for reconnaissance systems, and pass sensitive aerospace designs to unauthorized users. The GAO concluded that Israel conducts the most aggressive espionage operation against the United States of any U.S. ally. FBI counterintelligence officer John Cole has reported how many cases of Israeli espionage are dropped under orders from the Justice Department. He provides a conservative estimate of 125 viable investigations into Israeli espionage involving both American citizens and Israelis that were stopped due to political pressure. So the answer to the question, is Israel an ally of the United States, is most definitely no. Is it even a friend? If you judge Israel by its record on how it interacts with the American government and people, I think the answer would also have to be no.
On November 22, 2012, the 49th anniversary of Israel and the CIA assassinating JFK and lying about it, the U.S. Army committed open treason in Israel.
'11 has led directly to 60,000 Americans dead and wounded.
According to an FBI report, an Israeli employee of Urban Moving Systems, one of the many Mossad front companies involved in Operation 9/11, stated, quote, "Give us 20 years and we'll take over your media and destroy your country," end quote.
About time we stop apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None.
When I was a young senator, I say, if I were a Jew, I'd be a Zionist. I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
Progress occurs in the Middle East when everyone knows there's simply no space between the United States and Israel.
I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the Prime Minister of Israel, His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu.
No matter on which side of the aisle you sit, you stand with Israel.
And we will send a clear signal that there is no daylight between America and our most reliable ally, the State of Israel. I love Israel. I love Israel.
My personal prediction is that probably sooner than any of us realize or would like to envision, Israel is going to pull off another 9/11, another USS Liberty.
Everyone knows that what happened in October 7th was an Israeli setup. Everyone knows
what state of Israel. Look at him smile.
It was an Israeli setup. What happened in October 7th was an Israeli setup.
Need another 9/11. Need another 9/11. Need another 9/11.
Since this terrorist attack took place, we've seen it described as Israel's 9/11. But for a nation the size of Israel, it was like 15 9/11s.
When the U.S. military ordered Air Force members, such as Aaron Bushnell, to report for duty for Israel and participate in the Israeli genocide in Gaza, Bushnell's reaction was less jubilant than Mike Pompeo's.
Is Aaron Bushnell. I am an active duty member of the United States Air Force, and I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest, but compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal.
Copy, sir.
Free Palestine!
Hey.
Free Palestine! Free Palestine! Free Palestine! Free Palestine!
The night before his protest, Aaron Bushnell disclosed classified information to a friend confirming U.S. troops were on the ground in Gaza and were killing large numbers of Palestinians, underscoring that it's a joint U.S.-Israeli genocide. This aligns with a deleted White House Instagram post showing U.S. Delta forces deployed for Israel's so-called war in Gaza as early as October 20th, 2023. Bushnell, who frequently volunteered to serve homeless people in San Antonio, Texas, posted the following on social media just before his protest. Many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery, or the Jim Crow South, or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide? The answer is, you're doing it right now.
If you're wondering if Aaron had planned this out prior in advance, the answer is yes. Aaron had made a will, and he specified that his savings should be donated to the Palestine Children's Relief Fund.
With Bushnell on the ground, a security guard in front of the Israeli embassy rushed to point a gun at him, while an American voice said, "I don't need guns, I need fire extinguishers."
I don't need guns, I need fire extinguishers.
After Bushnell passed away, the Israeli Mossad commentary account on X labeled this courageous American an enemy and celebrated his demise. A flood of Israelis and Zionists heaped scorn, mockery, and insults on Bushnell and his sacrifice. Bushnell is not the first American to die protesting Israeli war crimes. When 23-year-old Rachel Corrie traveled to Gaza to non-violently oppose Israel's systematic and illegal demolition of Palestinian homes in 2003, the Israeli military intentionally ran her over with the blade of a weaponized Caterpillar bulldozer and murdered her.
She was at eye level with the driver of the bulldozer. She was up her head and upper torso were actually above the blade of the bulldozer. So he could very clearly see that she was there, her in her orange fluorescent jacket that she was wearing. But instead of stopping at this point, he continued forward until she was sucked all the way underneath the bulldozer.
Israel's chief pathologist reportedly then harvested her organs, something he previously admitted doing to other victims. In 2013, soldiers in the most immoral army on earth threw a Rachel Corrie pancake party to celebrate Israel's victory, flattening her.
I've been here for about a month and a half now, and this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. What I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying. The current Israeli government, I don't have a great deal of faith that they're going to listen to any message from me. I think it has become clear that this government does not care about the safety of its own people and doesn't care at all about the lives of Palestinian people. People's lives here are almost completely controlled by the Israeli government.
I think Americans largely get it. They know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Washington is Israel's most subservient colony.
It's a whole different country from what we thought it was. It's all fake.
I pledge allegiance to the false flags of the usurped states of Zionism and the Central Intelligence Agency, and to the propaganda for which it stands, one fascist empire of lies, playing God, unaccountable, with coups, wars, assassinations, terrorism, ethnic cleansing, and genocide for all.
And once the terror network has nuclear weapons, it is only a matter of time before those weapons will be used. You cannot prevent a dictator who has used terrorism in the past, who cavorts and supports and encourages terror organizations, from using this weapon by giving it to someone, by having them threaten to use it against his enemies.
So I have very little sympathy for what has become of that state. It's a satanic state. You know, you look at the polls, 60% of Israelis, 60% say Israel's not using enough force in Gaza.
Someday, somewhere, someone may find out the damn truth. We better, or we might just as well build ourselves another government, like the Declaration of Independence says to, when the old one ain't working. Patriot must always be ready to defend his country against its government. Individual human beings have to create justice, and this is not easy, because the truth often poses a threat to power, and one often has to fight power at great risk to themselves. The truth is the most important value we have, because if the truth does not endure, if the government murders truth, if we cannot respect the hearts of these people, then this is not the country in which I was born in, and it's certainly not the country that I want to die in. Tennyson wrote, "Authority forgets a dying king." This was never more true than for John F. Kennedy, whose murder was probably one of the most terrible moments in the history of our country. That's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Do not forget your dying king. Show this world that this is still a government of the people, for the people, and by the people. Nothing as long as you live will ever be more important. It's up to you.
Free America and Palestine from Zionism. If you found this video moving, share it with everyone you know. We can yet free humanity. It's going to require all of us to say three magic words. Israel did 9/11. We have to say it loud and proud. We have to shout it from the rooftops. Israel did 9/11. Israel cast a satanic curse on the entire world on September 11th, 2001. If we all say Israel did 9/11, it's going to break the curse, because all of the conflicts, all of the violence, all of the wars have been manipulated through deceit. When we tell the truth, it will set us free. For more content, visit truthtower.com, where I will post future episodes, and follow me on X at Truth Tower Pod.
They pretend that it's forgotten, but somewhere small flowers grow on the weathered stones of destroyed homes.
don't know their homes. They walk the streets from which they are forbidden. You see that we are rising. Our day is surely coming. No longer in the shadows of the ghosts.
أتحدى لا لا مستقبل سأعود بعزم ويقين أملي في يوم أن أرجع للأرض المحبوبة أرضي أتحدى لا يا مستقبل سنعود سنعود بعزم ويقين
now passed on, but it's their blood. Our hearts are pumping. They will walk with us when we return to their towns, whose names will live again. You see that we are rising. Our day is surely shadows of the ghosts, dear, you see. You see that we are rising. You know the fear is gone.
and he shall know the truth. And the truth shall make you free.
Do not forget your dying king.
Christ is king.